process is. So that's what I mean by biologic. Or, and biologically plausible would be something that fits with the pre-existing understanding of a condition.
So biologically plausible then can be used in within a hypothesis. It doesn't have to be proven.
What's that?
To be biologically plausible, we can still be talking about a hypothesis. It does not have to
be
proven.
Well, a biologically plausible factor or point is a starting point. So I'm suggesting that you go from something that's biologically plausible, and then you can confirm that through research and studies.
So it just means possible. It means possible.
Yes. Well, it means, yes, it means that something is can exist in the way that you're studying it, based on what is known.
To be biologically plausible, does there have to be reliable scientific studies to support the hypothesis?
Yes, you should have at least, if not studies, you should have some type of elucidation of the mechanism. For example, if someone makes an observation, even if studies are not yet done, biological plausibility with someone who explains, someone of a knowledgeable person who explains the mechanism that's observed would qualify for biological plausibility, even if several studies are not done yet.
I know in your testimony earlier you talked about Yates's profile, but your report also contains a number of hypotheses as to the cause of autism. Could you explain in detail what you think Yates's vaccinations did to cause his autism?
What I see in Yates' case, as far as profile and as far as the vaccines, and we'll just pick MMR for this discussion, is that we see a child who fits under the category of a child with regressive autism, normal development. He receives a set of vaccinations, and within a couple of months or so, give or take a few days, he starts to regress, and we have a child who has a lot of gastrointestinal problems. That is a set of conditions that have been found with many, many, many other children in a very similar fashion. And putting Yates in that profile is very important because, as I mentioned earlier, autism is not one disorder. There's so many causes of and contributing factors to autism. Some, for example, if I saw a female who was degenerating and whose head size was small, who was losing ability to use their hands, but also had autistic symptoms, I would think, aha, this fits with Rett syndrome. Or if I saw a child who had autistic characteristics but had a lot of seizures and had some abnormal patches on the skin, I would say, aha, this most likely is tuberous sclerosis. So basically, the profile that I talk about is basically a set of symptoms that collectively fit a pattern that's reproducible, a pattern that has been reported widely, and whose laboratory investigations fit also within that profile.
But do you know how the vaccines cause the autism? He fits a profile, but do you know what role exactly the vaccines played in that profile?
The role that I believe the vaccines play, based on the research that has been done, is that children with MMR who regress tend to have changes in the gut, ileonodular hyperplasia, which several researchers have found measles, persistence of measles virus in the gut. Studies in these similar groups, or some reports have also shown viruses in the brain. So the way that I believe that the autism was caused by the MMR is the vaccine impaired his immune system.
I'm sorry, which vaccine?
The measles. The measles. It probably also either went to the brain potentially, or he developed a post-immune reaction where the antibodies themselves went to the brain, and one of the two caused the regression leading to the autism along with the gastrointestinal symptoms.
You don't know which one, whether it was the antibody
I don't know which one because I didn't do a brain biopsy, so I can't say for sure.
Have you read the reports in the Cedillo hearing that were submitted in the testimony of the Cedillo hearing of Dr. Griffin, the virologist?
I've read several, but I don't know if I read that one in particular.
Have you read Dr. Ward's?
I may have, but I don't remember exactly. I looked at several of the reports, but I don't remember the names very well.
I'll ask you just a couple more if you're familiar with them. Dr. Buston?
I've heard of his report, yes.
Dr. Brent?
I've read some of his work from previous situations.
And did you read the report of Dr. Michael Gershon?
The name is familiar. I think I did, but I don't recall the detail.
Doctor, you've been a practicing neurologist for 5 years?
7 years.
7 years. And how long have you practiced in the Charlotte, North Carolina area?
I started practicing February 13th of this year, 2007.
And in your 7 years, how many autistic children have you treated?
I haven't counted specifically, but it's probably several hundred patients.
How are your patients referred to you?
A variety of ways, either through their pediatrician. A lot of patients have come through therapists, psychologists, or sometimes a patient will have an outside evaluation, say by a neuropsychologist, and then that therapist or that specialist will refer to me. So various specialists, and some parents also will come on their own. They've heard of me through, you know, different means, and will come.
Have you heard of Defeat Autism Now organization?
Yes, I have.
Do you get referrals from, and I'll call it Dan, do you get referrals from Dan?
I have in the past, yes.
Do you know what percentage of your practice are Dan referrals?
I'm not sure what percentage. It's a little hard to say because some parents, when they're researching a physician, they go online and let's say it's a patient who's interested in looking at biomedical things, they may come across Dan on the internet and then come that way. You know, they may see the name of a Dan practitioner and then they may come. So the referral could be made that way, so to speak.
Your name
Pardon
is on
me.
A,
I'm
counsel.
Sorry. I'm sorry. It's been drawn to my attention that we have to speak a little louder into
okay.
the mics, and we're all apparently soft-spoken. So if you could try to speak up a little bit.
I will.
That'd be great. Thank you.
I don't know if I answered your question, but what I'm trying to say is that there are some parents that do their own evaluation. For example, they say, okay, we want to find a particular type of doctor. So they go on the internet or they talk to people, and then my name comes up, and then they come back.
So if they go on the Dan website, they would find your name?
My name is not there right now, no. It was there up until when I left. It was there up until the time I came here.
You left Alabama? You're talking about
Montgomery? Up until I left Alabama to come to North Carolina. And, well.
Of the children you treat with autism, how many have been diagnosed with regressive autism?
I don't know the number. I haven't kept track of the number, but my guess would be a third or so. And the number could be higher, but the third would be those that probably truly have. There are some kids that superficially may present with regressive autism, but when you look at the history, you see that something else was going on. Maybe they had seizures, weakness, fussiness, or some other problem. So I don't count with those.
Of those children that you believe have true regressive autism, how many of those do you believe developed regressive autism as a result of vaccinations, either MMR or thimerosal or both?
Several. I haven't counted, but I do, in terms of profiling, I hear very similar stories over and over with certain types of patients, and all of those would be representative of what we see with Yates.
Would you say more than 50%?
50% of the regressive autism?
Yes.
Maybe, but I'm not sure. I've really not kept track in that way.
And of those numbers, how many do you believe developed regressive autism just as a result of the MMR vaccine?
Not very many. And there, let me elaborate. The reason is, I prefer to say contributed, because there are so many factors that I think play a role. Other vaccines, for instance, thimerosal, for instance, other environmental factors, some of which we still have yet to identify. So, you know, I wouldn't say just in most cases.
Doctor, you stated that you were on the DAN website while you were practicing in Montgomery, Alabama, but
yes.
You're no longer on it now?
Yes.
Why is that?
I've attended, I think, at least two or so or more DAN meetings, and the requirement in the past was to attend at least a meeting and to demonstrate a willingness to follow some of the principles of DAN, which I did. So I was listed as DAN. And then I think recently they came up with a rule. They sent a letter to everyone that in order to remain on the list, you have to attend a DAN meeting, I think at least once a year. And by attending the yearly DAN, that shows that you're still, you know, following some of the, you know, treatments and recommendations. I've not been able to attend in the past, oh, I don't know, 2 or 3 years, because I attend a lot of conferences. Although a lot of my practice is devoted to autism, I attend a lot of conferences for epilepsy, spasticity, cerebral palsy, so a lot of conferences. So I've had to balance those. So I've not been able to attend regularly.
Although you no longer attend the DAN meetings, do you still subscribe to the DAN protocol that is required?
I don't look at DAN as a rigid protocol, but I look at DAN as a movement. I've looked at a lot of the different therapies with DAN, and if I might answer your question by stating that the way I got involved with DAN is because before I'd ever heard of DAN, I was very involved in nutritional therapies myself, and then heard of DAN and thought, aha, here's a group of physicians that subscribe to biochemical and nutritional things. So I joined DAN. I think the DAN approach is very diverse. There are a lot of principles. For example, I believe that the gut, the brain, the immune system are related. So there are a lot of things in DAN that I still adhere to. I don't adhere to everything necessarily. I don't follow a rigid, a patient comes in, do this, do that first necessarily. So I use a lot of the principles because I think that they're justifiable.
When did you learn that Yates began to regress at 12 months of age?
The first I saw Yates initially in September of 2002, as far as I recall. He had been diagnosed at Vanderbilt, I think, in July, and my initial history was obtained at that time.
And what does that initial history say? Do you know? What is to the timing of the regression?
Okay. I think, I mean, I don't have it in front of me, but I think I might have reported 18 months, just like I did with this last case.
So when did you learn then that the regression began at 12 months of age?
I think I probably learned about it. I don't recall exactly when, but I can tell you that over the course of several visits, we've refined the history and findings. And I must say that the biggest refinement was yesterday. I got the clearest picture I've ever had with Yates, listening to the different family members, looking at the videos. I did review some videos beforehand, but you know, everything was put in a very clear manner today or yesterday.
But your report, which you filed in July, the premise is that the regression started after the vaccinations at 12 months of age, correct?
That's what I put in my report. That's correct.
For the record, the report to which you're referring is Petitioner's Trial Exhibit Number 1.
No, it's Dr. Corbier's report, which is...
His expert report?
His expert report, I'm sorry. Which is...
I actually, if I may correct, here's what I wrote on the July 2nd report. I wrote, he developed normally up until the age of 18 months to 24 months, but I then wrote, just prior to that, he started to have regression just prior. So the just prior, I admit, is not very clear, but you know, this is saying that it actually occurred before, and I'm not very specific as to before. But like I say, yesterday I was able to, you know, put the whole picture together and understand.
But your expert report, which is dated, which was filed in July, which is Petitioner's Exhibit 26. The basis for your expert report is that regression began at 12 months. Is that correct?
Well, I think I put in my report, I believe I put 12 to 18 months interval. I don't think that it's easy to just give a specific, you know, time when the regression, you know, I put it in an interval in my report, I believe. I can turn to that.
You also state, Doctor, in your report that timing is paramount to your diagnosis. Is that correct?
Yes.
And the timing from your testimony today, the paramount timing is 1 to 9 months following vaccination?
Yes. Putting all of the information that I have found in articles, we talked about biological plausibility, putting all of that information together and based on known reports of post-MMR encephalitis, I would put it in the 1 to 9 month period.
It seems like a broad range to be a paramount consideration. Would you agree?
Sure, it's a broad range. A lot of things tend to be very broad.
What vaccinations did Yates receive at 12 months?
He had the MMR.
You're looking this up? What do you have in front of you, Doctor?
I just have my report.
You have your Exhibit 26, your expert report?
Yes.
Okay.
I've noted here that he had the HIV, Hep B, MMR, and Prevnar.
You're referring to page 5.
Oh, I'm sorry, page 5, yes.
Which of those vaccines contained thimerosal?
I believe the Hep B, hepatitis B.
That's the only vaccine that contained thimerosal?
That I know of.
That you know of?
Correct.
Do you know how much thimerosal is contained in the Hep B vaccine?
Not off the top of my head, no.
Is there, your time frame is 1 to 9 months, correct, for you to determine that there's a causal vaccine relation, is that correct? One
yes.
to 9 months.
Yes. And not only vaccine, but also the live measles virus as far as an acute or a subacute encephalitis.
What is the time frame, absent the MMR, for a thimerosal-containing vaccine, following a thimerosal-containing vaccine, for regression to begin, that you would attribute the regression to the thimerosal-containing vaccine?
I'm not sure. I don't have a good paradigm for that one. And the studies that I have seen have not really addressed that question, so I cannot address that scientifically.
So you don't know?
I don't know.
If Yates's regression had occurred prior to 12 months, prior to the receipt of his MMR vaccine, would you have attributed his regression to his six-month vaccinations?
The lab indicated some problems with thimerosal, so I would have, included, as I do even now, the thimerosal as playing a role. Is that your question? I'm sorry.
No, I'm saying if absent the MMR vaccine, would you, I'm sorry, what I said is, had he started to regress prior to his 12-month vaccination, would you have attributed the regression to either his 6th or 9-month thimerosal-containing series of vaccinations?
What I would be able to say is that the thimerosal in the vaccines up to that point potentially played a role, contributed. That's all I would be able to say with any certainty.
Would that certainty, would the potentially, what weight would you give to the vaccines as playing a role in the autism, in the onset of autism or development of autism?
Are you talking about which
vaccine? What percentage?
I'm sorry, which vaccines?
The vaccines at 6 and 9 months.
Okay.
You say could potentially cause the autism.
There's no way for me to give a percentage because that's not been studied scientifically.
So you can't say more likely than not?
I could say more likely than not that that was a contributing factor. Yes, that I can say.
So greater than 50%, you can attribute a percentage
that
to it.
That played a role, yes.
What is the basis for that opinion?
Well, the basis is I was very struck by the fact that at six months shots, he had a screaming episode, which I think, to the best of my ability, was probably linked to the pertussis. He screamed uncontrollably for several hours, according to the testimony we heard yesterday. For a neurologist or a pediatrician, if a patient screams uncontrollably, we think of irritability. We think that there's something wrong. And so the only thing that I could link based on the history to that screaming episode would have been the pertussis. And therefore, I think that played a role. That's an indicator, in other words, that the vaccine played a role, that he had some type of reaction.
And is the six-month reaction reflected in the medical records, or is that from the testimony you heard yesterday?
I've heard it before as well. I heard it in greater clarity yesterday in terms of the duration, but in fact, I think that might be in my report here, so I must have heard it before.
Is it, to your knowledge, reflected in the contemporaneous medical records? A reaction to the six-month vaccination.
Are you referring to the pediatricians?
Yes.
No. I don't recall, but I can tell you that I reviewed the pediatrician's record and didn't feel that it was very thorough, so it wouldn't be too surprising if that was not included.
Did Yates exhibit signs of an encephalopathy due to his pertussis vaccine?
The screaming for several hours in an inconsolable way is what many people would call an encephalopathy, albeit temporary, but an encephalopathy. In other words, he was in an encephalopathic state. He was crying, he could not be consoled. So likely, if you try to look at Yates, he probably would not, interact in any meaningful way. So we could use the term encephalopathy in that state, in that condition.
And how does pertussis cause a encephalopathic state, because there were no sequelae of that encephalopathy. He didn't regress at 6 months, is that correct?
He didn't have, I don't think he had encephalitis, I think he had encephalopathy. If you have an encephalitis, that can cause damage to neurons, neuronal loss, and that can lead to sequelae. For example, if you have a herpes encephalitis or any type of encephalitis, you have death of brain cells. An encephalopathic state can occur with a variety of things. Certain drugs can make you encephalopathic. Head trauma can make you encephalopathic temporarily, and you can recover. So encephalopathy, all it means is a disease state of the brain, and it could be due to any number of causes. It can last any number of time or any length of time.
Why is it your opinion that it was caused by the pertussis?
I just don't have a better explanation, and I know, based on the CDC, that crying for several hours is one of the things that should be instructed to parents to look out for, that along with other manifestations. So based on that, I think that that's likely what happened. I can't prove it, but that's likely.
And you don't know how pertussis would do that, do you? Or do you?
Do I know how pertussis would cause the encephalopathy?
Yes.
I know how regular pertussis would. Regular pertussis, and I'm not talking about the acellular pertussis, but the whole cell pertussis has three neurotoxins that can affect neurons in a very adverse way and can cause a lot of neurological symptoms. The way the acellular pertussis can cause a child to scream, I don't know that that's been elucidated, but it is something that pediatricians are instructed to warn parents about.
If we accept that Yates had a reaction at 6 months of age, how critical is this event to your opinion that Yates' autism was caused by his later vaccinations?
To me, his reaction, or I should say possible reaction to be precise, to the what I think was the pertussis, just tells me that he may have some type of underlying predisposition that caused him to scream for several hours. After all, not every child who receives a pertussis vaccine would scream, but I don't think I think that's one among several factors, and that's why I like to always use the term contributing factors. I think that could have played a role, thimerosal could have played a role, maybe other vaccines could have played a role, but it just adds to the notion that he likely had a reaction. He was prone or susceptible to reaction.
On page 4 of your expert report, you indicate that you performed a 24-hour EEG on Yates?
Yes.
How is a 24-hour EEG taken? What is your role in administering that EEG?
My role in obtaining maybe I should just, for clarity, just to kind of explain. First of all, an EEG is an electroencephalogram. It's a brainwave test that allows us to determine several things. It allows us to determine whether a child is likely having seizures. It tells us what the status of the brain cells are. It actually looks at the cortex of the brain. The reason why sometimes we'll do a 24-hour EEG is that a routine EEG, which can last 30 minutes, or even a little longer EEG that lasts 1 hour, can miss certain things going on in the brain. It's not unusual for a patient who has a lot of seizures to have a normal routine EEG because the abnormal signals in the brain, the abnormal electrical activity occurs periodically. So it's a snapshot picture in time. So the 24-hour EEG just enhances our chances of finding abnormalities that you might miss on a routine EEG. Moreover, when I do a 24-hour EEG on a patient with autism, I'm looking for some specific problems that can present as autism that I'd like to rule out, such as static epilepticus of slow wave sleep. That is a condition that may not show on routine EEGs, but when you enter deep stages of sleep, the EEG becomes continuously abnormal in the parietal occipital areas. If I saw such a patient, whether Yates or someone else, that would lead me to a very specific direction. We talked about profiles. I would say, aha, here's an EEG that indicates a particular seizure syndrome. Let me treat the seizure and see if I can get the child to speak or improve based on that diagnosis.
And what did you read on this EEG?
I found that he had intermittent bifrontal central and generalized epileptiform discharges.
And was this EEG ever read by a neurologist who is board certified in clinical neurophysiology?
No, but I don't think that's necessary because I'm a board certified child neurologist and I've trained with some of the best epileptologists, so it's not necessary for the EEG to be reviewed. Now, if I do have a question, I'll never hesitate to confer with a colleague or an epileptologist. If I'm not sure, if I think that there's a questionable finding, then usually I'll be the first one to call or send a copy of the EEG for review. But if I'm confident with my findings, then there's usually no need to have an epileptologist confirm the EEG. That's part of our training.
So if you had, what epileptologist have you studied with and where?
I studied with Dr. Privatera at the University of Cincinnati when I did my year of adult neurology, and Dr. Tracy Glauser, who's one of the most renowned pediatric epileptologists in the country, perhaps the world. And he was at the Children's Hospital of Cincinnati where I did my fellowship training.
What is an epileptologist?
An epileptologist is a neurologist that does further training in the field of epilepsy, whether epilepsy surgery, whether epilepsy treatment, or a variety of aspects of epilepsy. So an epileptologist has completed their neurology training, and then they do a year or two of extra training in epilepsy-related things, treatment.
Are you an epileptologist?
No, I'm not an epileptologist. I'm a general child neurologist.
Has Yates ever been diagnosed with clinical seizures?
There was a suspicion, and I can't remember if it was at 9 months. Let me see. He had an episode of staring at one point and was seen by a neurologist in Tennessee. Let me see if I can. He saw Dr. Mark Brueggemann. This was on May 13, 2002. I'm looking at on page 3 under the neurological profile. And I don't recall seeing what his final impression was, but his exact words were, he wrote several, he basically was staring off for several minutes and, quote, still not back to himself. He did an EEG at that time that was unremarkable. I don't recall what the report says, but most neurologists, when they read an EEG, will put as a disclaimer, a normal EEG does not rule out seizures. To me, that episode looks like a seizure. The only way to truly confirm that episode was a seizure would be to obtain an EEG while he's staring, which most of the time we don't have that luxury. So you have to go by clinical findings and then give your level of suspicion based on your expertise.
But was there a diagnosis of clinical seizures? There was a possibility of seizures.
You mean by Dr. Brueggemann?
Yeah. Yes.
I don't recall seeing it. I didn't write that in my report. I don't remember what his diagnosis was.
Where are you currently employed, Dr. Corbier?
I'm employed in Concord, North Carolina. At Concord, North Carolina, CMC Medical Center, CMC Northeast Medical Center.
Is that a hospital?
It's a hospital multi-specialty group practice. I think we're probably 200 physicians and multiple pediatrics subspecialists in this group.
Do you have hospital privileges in the
yes,
Charlotte area? At what hospital?
It's called CMC Northeast Medical Center.
And And did you have hospital privileges when you were practicing in Montgomery, Alabama?
Yes, since I started practicing up until now, I've always had hospital privileges.
Why did you leave Montgomery?
I left Montgomery for several reasons. When I was doing my training in Cincinnati, I was approached by the medical director who asked me to join the faculty to do research in pediatric stroke. I was going to do it, but I decided instead to go into private practice. I've been in private practice for 6 years in Montgomery and worked well, enjoyed the clinical setting. But I was kind of missing the intellectual side of things in terms of possibility of doing research, possibility of doing medical education, teaching residents and others. In Montgomery, I did not do a lot of these things and wanted to kind of change that a little bit. The other factor is that I was in solo practice, and if you know anything about solo practice, it means long hours, working all of the time. My wife, who's a pediatrician, was helping me run the office. We have a 10-year-old son that we were both trying to see patients, work all the time, and homeschool in the office. So that became a little stressful, so I decided to seek employment somewhere where I could be employed, not have to have that amount of stress, and still continue or pursue my interests in academia, teaching, and other areas. So that's why I left.
But yeah, 100% of you said 100% of your time is devoted to your clinical practice, correct, at this point?
At this time it is. There's a very large research campus that's being built not too far from my hospital, and one of the reasons I chose Northeast is to hopefully have the opportunity to be involved in research. I also chose this particular hospital because it's associated with Duke, and there are a lot of collaborative things that we would like to be able to do in the future.
What is Manotech?
Manotech, there's a company out of Texas called Manotech. Manotech is a company that produces a type of nutrient called glyconutrient. The flagship product is Ambritose. Ambritose is a product that contains 8 sugars, including xylose, mannose, eucose, neuraminic acid, and the company basically has found a way to patent these 8 sugars into a particular product. They've gone on to market other nutraceuticals, all of which contain these 8 sugars, multivitamins, digestive enzymes. So that's what Manotech is.
And you prescribe it to your patients?
I'm what I call myself. I call myself a nutritional neurologist, which means that a lot of my practice, almost from day one, up until the present, I spend a lot of time talking about nutrition, as I believe that dietary interventions are important. I became interested in Manotech based on prior interest in a specific neurometabolic disorder called congenital disorders of glycosylation. When I was in Cincinnati, I took care of a young child who was about 8 or 9 and kept having recurrent strokes. I mentioned earlier that I was going to join the faculty to do pediatric stroke, and here I was. I saw a little girl having strokes for no apparent reason and multiple other problems. We're able to diagnose her with a specific problem with glycosylation, which means that she herself had a substance called glycoprotein, which are protein with a sugar moiety, and her body, for some reason, she was lacking a particular enzyme. She was not able to make one of the sugars called neuraminic acid. I became very interested in that disorder. At the time, there were about 50 cases described in the country. I took care of 3 of them and interacted with several kids throughout the world with this condition. I've given several conferences on this particular disorder, and my conclusion or thesis, especially to neurology conferences, was that this problem was probably underdiagnosed. I thought that many individuals might have a glycosylation disorder. I'm getting to your question, but yeah. I called Mark Patterson, who's a child neurologist at Mayo Clinic. I did part of my training at the Mayo Clinic, and he was having success treating some patients with this disorder with a particular subtype called congenital disorders of glycosylation type 1B. This is the type where children present with a lot of gastrointestinal problems. They're bloated, they have massive diarrhea, they have blood in the stools. So I said to Dr. Patterson, you know, have you thought of using this mannose, which is a sugar that's implicated in the immune system, with other disorders, in particular other congenital disorders of glycosylation? He said he had tried, it was not effective. I thought of the glycosylation disorders for a long time, and when I became involved with autism, I thought that maybe a subset of children, perhaps a large subset, might have problems with glycosylation. People in Montgomery and in the area knew that I was involved with nutrition, so there's a lady that came to me and said, I see that you're involved with nutrition. Have you heard of glyconutrients? And I told her, no, I've never heard of that. In other words, I've never heard of the product that she presented. But I told her, as I usually do, I'll listen. You know, when people come to me and they present new ideas, I try to be open-minded. So she explained to me about the eight sugars. I said, I know about mannose and these other sugars. And she says, you know, people are doing quite well with this. I said, well, let me see the research. And it dawned on me that this was something that I could add to the list of things that I recommended beyond vitamins, minerals, essential fatty acids. But I told her, before I put anyone on this, I need to do research. I spent several weeks, if not months, researching everything I could on this particular supplement, and then decided to go to Texas, where Manatech Company is located. I spoke to leading physicians, researchers, pathologists, neurosurgeons, a lot of people who were, and biochemists involved with this, and made up my mind that this is something that I needed to recommend to my patients, along with other things that I recommend. So I started to recommend Manatech, and I must say that a subset of children who have taken the glyconutrients have done quite well. Not everyone, I've not found a therapy yet that, you know, that works for everyone, but several people did respond to treatment with glyconutrients in terms of their symptoms.
What research did you review?
For what?
To conclude that these substances would work.
I reviewed a lot of studies by, there's a biochemist, I'm blanking on his name. He was the first one to look at the role of mannose. I looked at research from a pathologist, his name is Dr. Reg McDaniels. Omalchek and several others who had written on the use of glyconutrients. I also reviewed, in looking at how this might work, I reviewed work from Dr. Hudson Freeze, who's in Loyola, California. I had called up Hudson Freeze because he, when I was researching congenital disorders of glycosylation, he had collaborated with me and sent me some of his slides for some of my presentations. So I looked up some of his work as well in my research of the glyconutrients and how they might work in health patients.
You've given presentations. Have you ever published on this?
On what?
Glycosylation?
Oh, glycosylation. I've not published, but given several grand rounds to neurologists and pediatricians and medical individuals. Probably the reason I've not published on this, though I would like to, is that when I moved from Cincinnati to Montgomery, my emphasis gradually shifted from congenital disorders of glycosylation to autism. So I kind of, not necessarily lost interest, but most of my focus and energy was diverted to autism.
Did any of the studies you looked at look at the glycosylation in autism?
Did any? I did not see any direct studies, but I did see several things that might implicate glycosylation to autism, such as there have been several studies with the glyconutrients that have looked at gastrointestinal problems. As I mentioned, children with congenital disorders of glycosylation, especially type 1B, have a lot of gastrointestinal difficulties, which I thought was applicable to autism. Also, some of the most robust studies have been done with the immune system, looking at glyconutrients for autoimmune disorders such as lupus, HIV, and other conditions. knowing what I know, say, from studies with Dr. Ashwood and others who have looked at the immune system, and Dr. Zimmerman and others in autism, I thought that this would be a very good fit in terms of applicability. But I didn't see any study. In fact, that's one thing that I was starting to work on, is I was starting to maybe develop some informal studies that I might pursue down the road.
Is MannoTech FDA approved for the treatment of autism?
It's listed for autism?
Yes.
Unfortunately, the only thing that's FDA approved for autism is the drug Risperdal, and that FDA approval just came 1 year ago. So in essence, all of the physicians, myself included, we were using unproven therapy as far as Risperdal, but it did finally get FDA approved. So no other drug that is used in autism, whether it's a stimulant or SSRI, nothing has at all been FDA approved for autism. In fact, most drugs are not even FDA approved for kids. Most of the drugs we use, we know they work. We know that they have a safety record for other conditions. So many pediatricians, neurologists, doctors feel safe using them in the kids. Good example is epilepsy. Very few drugs for epilepsy are approved in the very young children. So if we have a one-month-old who does not respond to, say, phenobarbital, instead of letting a child have a seizure until they die, we'll use a drug that we think is safe, although there's no approval. So to answer your question, since most drugs are not approved for FDA, it's even harder for a supplement to get approval from the FDA.
Pardon me, Dr.
Cloutier,
please make sure to help me make sure I'm oriented. You refer to SSRI?
Oh, yes, that's selective serotonin inhibitors. These are antidepressants. They're used a lot in some children with autism because some children with autism have mood disorders. In fact, talking about profile, and I'm a big believer in profiling, there's a group of children with autism who they look very depressed. And if you treat their depression properly, their autism symptoms will disappear. We call that pseudo-autism. Very important disorder, because if you can identify that a child's autistic symptoms are actually due to some neurochemical defects that really cause a lot of emotional symptoms, mood problems, depression, and you treat it correctly, that child with that specific antidepressant treatment will resolve the autistic symptoms. So that's what SSRI is.
What is MannoTech FDA approved for?
What's that?
What is MannoTech FDA approved for?
Well, anything? I don't know that it's FDA approved, but it's been looked at. It's received a patent, and it's in the PDR, physician desk reference. So if you look at the PDR, you'll see Ambritose. I don't remember the specific indications, but all of the attributes of Ambritose are listed, like other things that are listed in the physician desk reference.
I want to move on to page 6 of your expert report, which you call the pertinent factors in Yates's case.
Yes.
And I want to look specifically at the first 5 bullets.
Yes.
Do you rely on all of these bullets in combination for your conclusion that the development of Yates's autism was vaccine-related?
You're saying, do I rely on all of them collectively?
Yes.
Yes, each one I think is important, but each additional bullet point adds further credence or further support to that belief.
I'd like to go through these then one at a time, and if you could tell me, I'll ask some questions following up. How important is it, in your opinion, that Yates was normal prior to the development of his autism?
In terms of the MMR?
Yes.
Vaccine. It's only important based on the timing. In other words, if the regression occurred at 11 months, obviously that would not be of any significance. But the fact that there was regression noted sometime after 12 months, I think, is the starting point. We have an event or an intervention, in this case, a set of vaccines. Subsequently, we have regression. So the starting point is to ask myself, is it possible that the vaccines played a role? And until I have further information with that particular first bullet point, the answer is maybe it's coincidence, or maybe there's something to this association.
And how important is that factor, in your opinion, that thimerosal-containing vaccines caused Yates to develop autism?
As I've noted throughout my report, I'm a believer, based on all of the studies and research, that we're dealing with, in many cases of autism, with several factors, such as far as vaccines, thimerosal may play a role. I mentioned my belief that Yates was sickly, so if thimerosal contains mercury that can further weaken your immune system, that can have an adverse role, not to mention that mercury can cause autistic symptoms. So we have to look at all of the factors involved, and there are many. I might add that I think that his addiction to milk at one point probably had something to do with it as well, or at least contributed to some of his symptoms. The parents reported that there was a time, I think it was in Norway, I don't know if it was a little bit before as well, where he was addicted to milk, while some researchers like Dr. Paul Shadoff and Panksepp have looked at opioid therapies or opioid theories for autism. Some children with autism are unable to digest casein. Casein is a protein that's found in dairy products. And there are a variety of reasons why some children with autism are unable to digest the casein. And when they try to digest it, it gets converted to a peptide called casomorphine, which is similar to morphine. And that can make the child have a variety of symptoms. Notice in the report, though, that when they went on the gluten casein-free diet, he did get somewhat better, not completely better, but he got a little bit better. So I would say it's a fair assumption that by going on a gluten casein-free diet, they removed that particular contributing factor. He got a little bit better, but I think it's not until he saw Dr. Bowie and was placed on some medications that he had some real relief from his gastrointestinal symptoms.
So milk was a contributing, is one of the contributing factors?
Milk was a contributing factor, in my opinion, to some of the symptoms he developed. Not necessarily causing it, but it probably made some of his symptoms, aggravated some of his symptoms.
The second bullet is Yates had evidence of a compromised immune system.
Yes.
How critical is that factor to your opinion that Yates' vaccines played a role in his development of autism?
I can't give you a percentage. It helps. It's not a necessary component, but it does help. I say that it helps because immunological problems are widely reported in children with autism, including children with gastrointestinal problems. One mechanism by which vaccines such as, or vaccine adjuvants like thimerosal causes problems is by altering the immune system. So the fact that Yates was sickly adds to the picture, the profile.
So assuming all other factors, but Yates had a normal immune system, would that change your opinion that his development of autism was vaccine-related?
That's a difficult question because how would I prove that his immune system was normal? Do you mean if he was not as sickly, perhaps? Normal children can get 6 to 10 infections per year when they're very young. So are you saying if Yates had, say, 6 to 6 infections per year, for example, and was not as sickly as he has been, would that change my opinion, are you saying?
Yes, let's say he only had 6 infections.
Yes, let's say he had just a few infections, as it's recognized that you can have a few infections early on. That would not alter my opinion. What I mentioned in terms of the MMR, if the other factors were present, some of the other critical factors.
How critical is the third factor that Yates was sick at the time he received his MMR vaccination?
Based on CDC recommendations that if a child is moderately ill, that vaccine should be postponed, I think that that is yet another contributing factor. Yates, I argue, had a compromised immunological system and perhaps had an underlying genetic vulnerability. So it was very risky, in my opinion, to give child vaccines who was sick at the time. What I would have maybe recommended would have been to postpone the vaccine and not to give it in a state where he might be further immunologically compromised by having an infection.
So if we take all of your other pertinent factors, and assuming all those factors, but he was perfectly healthy at the time he had received his MMR vaccination, would that have changed your opinion that the MMR was related to the development of his autism?
It depends what type of information I had. If, for example, his gastrointestinal workup did not show that he had lymphonodular hyperplasia and colitis, it would, I'm sorry, Doc.
I'm saying all other circumstances the same.
Okay.
Okay. Except that Yates was perfectly healthy at the time he received his MMR vaccination. Would that change your opinion?
No, it wouldn't, because we do see a subset of children who seem healthy, and after vaccines, they get really sick. That would not change. I just think that in Yates' case, it demonstrates the coexistence of underlying genetic predisposition and environmental etiology coming together to cause problems.
So it's not a pertinent factor in your decision?
Well, I didn't say it wasn't pertinent, but the more
it's not necessary.
Yes, that would be a better characterization.
Yates had no family history of autism. How important is that factor to your decision, to your opinion that MMR vaccine played a role in his development of autism?
It's important in the sense that if Yates, for instance, had had multiple family members with autism, I would really strongly think that he had a specific either genetic or neurometabolic problem, perhaps that I might be able to identify. For instance, there are, at this time, approximately 100 candidate genes that have been looked at with autism, and there have been familial forms that have been identified. So if Yates had multiple family members that had autism, I would think, you know, maybe genes are playing a bigger role. Now, when I say genes, it's important to understand that some children with autism have identifiable genetic abnormalities that can be proven with the lab. For example, fragile X or neurometabolic disorders that are genetically based, such as PKU. But there are other children who have a genetic predisposition, but detailed genetic testing, as in the case of Yates, does not reveal anything. So the fact that he did not have any family history that we know of just is yet another point to suggest that we're dealing with a problem where environmental factors play a significant role.
What percentage of children with regressive autism have no family history of autism?
Studies show that autism in general, whether regressive or non-regressive, there are many families that don't actually have a family history of autism. There is, however, a higher concordance rate if you look at twin studies, for example. But what has been shown is that there are a lot of family members that may have traits. For example, you may have a child with autism, and there's a fairly good chance that a member may have speech delay, dyslexia, some other symptoms. When you look specifically, though, at regressive autism, I don't know what the numbers are in terms of family history. Yes, right. I'm not sure what that is. It's probably, I would suspect, higher than the general population, but not necessarily very high.
On page 9 of your report, you have a section called Where is the Lesion?
Yes.
And you state that the most important point that can be made clinically is that all parts of the brain can be involved with autism. Is that correct?
Yes.
And you believe that all parts of the brain can be involved in autism?
I do.
What is the basis for that opinion?
First of all, if I may back up just a little bit, I want to explain why I wrote Where's the Lesion? I'm an ordinary child neurologist, and based on my training, what all neurologists in the United States are taught to do when confronted with any neurological problem is to ask that very question, where is the lesion? Asking that question can help you to arrive at the proper diagnosis. So that's why I chose to put this in this form. When we ask the question as neurologists, where is the lesion, before we get any type of labs, the first thing we try to do is, first of all, get a good history, and I mentioned earlier that history taking is important in arriving at the right diagnosis. The next thing that we do as neurologists is to do a good neurological examination. Most of the times, with a good history and a good neurological examination, if you've done your job correctly, you should be able to arrive at a very reasonable diagnosis, or at least a reasonable differential diagnosis. And then if you're not sure, you may get supportive tests such as labs, EEGs, MRIs. Recall that I also said that autism is not one disorder. Autism, there are a lot of different causes for autism. And what has been shown through both neuropathological studies, case reports, volumetric MRI studies, is that various parts of the brain are affected. I did mention the case, I think it was Cindy, I think it was the first report in my list, of a person who presented with autism due to lesions in an atypical area. He had herpes encephalitis that affected the frontal lobe, usually herpes encephalitis affects the temporal lobe. He went on to develop classic autistic symptoms. While there are some studies that say, well, you must have temporal lobe involvement, well, this person did not have temporal lobe involvement. If you just look at clinical manifestations of children with autism, they may have visual processing problems that points to the occipital lobe. They may have mood memory problems that points to the limbic system. They may have executive problems, motor problems that points to the frontal lobe. They may have hand flapping, involuntary movements that points to the basal ganglia. And many studies have implicated the cerebellum as being involved. When I review the literature to see what parts of the brain are likely involved, I see contradictions. Not because the studies are inadequate or because they're bad, but because probably they're looking at different groups of individuals. I suspect that some individuals may not have any visible changes at all if you did a biopsy. The problem is when you diagnose someone with autism, there's not a single laboratory test that you can do that confirms the person has autism. In fact, you do not even have to be a medical doctor to make an official diagnosis of autism. A psychologist can make the diagnosis. I mentioned this pseudo-autism, which is caused by depression. Someone like that would not have any lesions at all, not in the temporal lobe, not in the limbic system, and so forth. So my assertion that any and all parts of the brain can be involved is based on different reports of different areas being involved. Also knowing any good neurologist who applies the rules that we're taught as neurologists to ask where is the lesion should come up with the fact that this is a diffuse problem which involves various brain structures. So it is in that sense that I say any and all part of the brain can be implicated.
Is it your opinion that both thimerosal-containing vaccines and the MMR vaccine worked in concert to cause Yates to develop autism?
I believe that both of them had an impact. When you say in concert, I don't know that one caused the other, but I know that both of them, based on the laboratory evaluation that I have, very likely played a role. In the case of the thimerosal, I see evidence of oxidative stress due to his low glutathione. I see his porphyrins, his urinary porphyrins, porphyrin being very elevated. So that all that tells me is that there is evidence, laboratory evidence, that there's an insult caused by mercury, causing these laboratory changes. They don't get their studies. That's shown, Dr. James has shown that if you compare kids with autism versus kids who do not have autism, if you look at their glutathione level, intracellular glutathione, whole glutathione is lower in children with autism, which makes sense. It fits with everything we know about autism, mercury toxicity, other problems, than those that do not. So in that sense, I would say that yes, the mercury component of the thimerosal, and then the MMR, I see evidence, you know, laboratory-wise, that strongly suggests that this was not just a coincidence, it's regression post-MMR.
But you don't have a hypothesis as to how both of them combined work, working in concert.
Well, in concert in the sense that if you weaken the immune system, we know that thimerosal is a neurotoxic. So if we have evidence that thimerosal is involved, which we do, and that we know that it can depress neuronal function or brain cell function, and if we know that measles can affect the gut and can also affect the brain, then in concert you can say that there's possibly a synergistic effect of the two.
What is the evidence that thimerosal causes neuronal? You said neuronal.
Oh yes, neuronal
dysfunction. Is that what you?
Yes, neuronal. There have been several studies that have looked at, and some are listed here, blanking on the name of the author. But what they've done is they've compared thimerosal and methylmercury. Most of the studies have initially been done with methylmercury, which is an organic. Which is an organic mercury. Thimerosal contains ethyl mercury, which is a different form of organic mercury. So what scientists have asked is, could thimerosal cause similar problems as far as the brain to that of or methyl mercury? And the answer that was found is yes. And as I mentioned earlier, and I don't remember the author's name, it's been found that when thimerosal goes to the brain, it actually converts to inorganic mercury, which binds very strongly to brain cells at a rate that's 7 times faster than methyl mercury. Also, scientists have said, well, let's look at thimerosal. After all, thimerosal contains not only ethyl mercury, it also contains thiosalicylates. Thiosalicylate is just yet another component in thimerosal. So one researcher asked, how do we know that it is specifically the ethyl mercury that's causing problems in the brain? Maybe it's the thiosalicylate. What that particular study showed is that the thiosalicylate did not affect the immune system, but the ethyl mercury did. It affected the brain as well as the immune system. It suppressed the T cells. So I think there's growing evidence to support the fact that ethyl mercury is neurotoxic, and I think that was part of the basis for the AAP and Human Health Services and other groups coming together to recommend the quick removal of thimerosal from the vaccine.
At what dose is ethyl mercury neurotoxic? Are these papers talking about ethyl mercury at the doses that are contained in thimerosal-containing vaccines?
I think some studies are a little bit misleading, or I think designed or not designed properly, because we should not necessarily be talking about dosages or doses. Now, we know that the EPA said that if you have 187.5 micrograms of thimerosal, that exceeds the limit that they consider safe, not for kids, but even for adults.
Who said that?
The EPA.
Said that about ethyl mercury?
What's that?
The EPA said what about ethyl mercury?
No, they said that the level of mercury that is considered above what is considered safe is a cumulative dose of 187.5 micrograms. It was based on that recommendation, in large part, that the recommendation was made to remove thimerosal from the vaccines. However, I don't think looking at, and that was for, I think, methylmercury, but they applied it as well to ethylmercury.
The EPA applied it to ethylmercury?
Yes, they did, because ethylmercury is also an organic mercurial, just like methylmercury. And a lot of the data, most of the data, the initial data was with methylmercury. All the epidemiologic, Seychelles Island, Farrell's Island, Minamata disease, these were all based on methylmercury. but some researchers have shown that apomercury is also not only neurotoxic, but also it impairs the immune system.
What studies are you discussing that say that dimerisol suppresses the immune system?
There's a study, let me see if I can find it. It's in one of the lists. In this, but it's basically a study. What that study did was, that's the same study that I'm referring to that looked at dimerisol and the subcomponents, ethyl mercury and